Hey, everybody. Welcome to Post Political Podcast. I'm the host, Derek Britton, and I have an amazing guest tonight. I am very, very excited about him. First off, let's get the ads out to you guys. I'm going to play the VSI one first and then Brewed Coffee right after.
The Vermin Supreme Institute. Our purpose is to inspire social evolution through the disruption of authoritarianism, to promote compassion and activism, and to spread knowledge of redacted history. Through the use of humor, direct action, and mutual aid, we uplift the disaffected, the disenfranchised, and the disempowered.
So I was stumbling over these every episode before this, so I recorded these previously. Tell me how you like them in the comments. I'm going to play the Brewed Coffee one, and let me know.
Brewed Coffee in Lexington, Kentucky. Go to my affiliate link in the comments, and you can go and check out what they have for sale. They have clothing, whole beans, K-cups, coffee mugs, all sorts of stuff. Check it out at brewedco.com and use my affiliate link in the comments. Thanks.
So, everyone, I have a extremely special guest. He was the 2020 nominee for vice president from the Libertarian Party. He is one of my good friends, libertarian activist, anarchist, and just great overall person, Spike Cohen. So, everyone, welcome Spike.
How's it going? Hey, everybody. I'm doing fantastic, man. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, this is great. Now, I obviously wanted to bring you on as soon as I possibly could, but also, you know, build up a little bit of some folks that jump on and have some different ideas. So I started this podcast to do a general, third party, politically homeless folks trying to find a place and wanting to collaborate and come together and work on, you know, something that's part of their platform that they really care about, really passionate about, but they might not, you know, be in the same political party as the other person. So
Yeah. People that recognize that the Republicrat machine is never going to serve them.
Exactly. Yeah. So speaking of which, I kind of wanted to do, you know, the introduction on for yourself, you know. How did you get to the, I guess, third party system? What was your route here? And what was kind of the last straw, I guess, that made you really leave from the two party system into, the Libertarian Party or wherever your journey went?
So I think the last straw with me, I was very much, I was not only a Republican conservative type, I was a neocon. Like, I was kind of the worst, actually. And And it was out of 9/11. So when 9/11 happened, I was 19, and I was horrified and I was scared and I was worried that this was going to be our new normal and I needed something to protect us. And what were we going to do? Well, government and corporate media, the Republicrat machine told me that, well, the problem is that terrorists hate us because we're just so darn free. And the only way that we're going to be able to protect ourselves is to make them very darn free, too. So we're going to go over there and we're going to topple their terrible dictators. Now, they never mentioned the fact that our government installed most of those dictators, but exactly. We're going to topple those terrible dictators and make them free and bring real democratic values to their country so that they can be as free as us and then we can all get along together. And if anyone tries to stop us, we'll murder them. And now saying it sounds stupid, but I absolutely wholeheartedly believed all of it. And, yeah. You know, back then, you know, one of the people, ironically, who was also a Republican, one of the people who was the most loud against that, who spoke in a way that connected with me because I was more on the conservative side of things, was Ron Paul. Yep. And, you know, he would talk about the fact that, you know, we're creating an empire. We are not free. Things like the Patriot Act are only going to make our lives more difficult and are not going to make us any safer. And that the only way to fix this stuff is to end these wars, bring the troops home, you know, get rid of these absurd infringements on our lives and rights and property. At the same time as my business that I had started when I was a teenager was continuing to become more and more successful, I was paying more and more taxes and going under more and more regulation. And I thought, I feel like I'm being punished. Like, I didn't do anything wrong. I'm not a billionaire or anything like that. Yep. I'm just trying to make a good living and be able to build a financial legacy so that I don't have to work hard for the rest of my life and eventually will be able to live off the fruit of my own labor. Yep. And what ended up happening was between those two things, I realized, wow, government sucks at everything. And then I also watching the political theater between Republicans and Democrats, it was very easy to spot the pattern. One party gets in, on a bunch of promises. They don't accomplish it. This party pretends that they're fighting against them. After this party loses popularity, this party gets in and fails on all their promises, and this party pretends to oppose them. And it's this sort of, you know, sweeping motion back and forth. It's the left boot, right boot, left boot, right boot step marching forward. And the only people that benefit from this are, you know, incredibly powerful people who pay for all of them to be in office.
Exactly.
And so I actually went all the way towards becoming a non-voting anarchist, where I was like, this whole system needs to just be obliterated, and we need to just opt out completely, and voting is violence, and all of this stuff. And I started talking with other anarchists who were Libertarian Party members, and I'm like, what are you doing? You know, we want to, and they'd say voting is violence, and voting to try to stop what they're doing is an act of defense. It is defensive violence. You are using proxy violence like everyone else, but your violence is in defense of yourself and everyone else. Your violence is saying, no, let's stop doing this stuff. Let's put people in office who won't do these things. And we can argue over what level of effectiveness that has, but the bottom line is that it is a form of defense. And when you harness the electoral process and use the unearned deference that comes with it, you can bring people into that message. I just traveled around the country as the vice presidential candidate, and I got way more attention than I would have gotten if I had traveled around the country as Spike Cohen, who has some very strong opinions that he thinks you should hear. And so there is a way to leverage the electoral process to bring people into the message of greater maximizing human liberty. And then also we can potentially also win elections and start affecting change, not just at the cultural level and the conversational level of the public debate, but also in the actual electoral and policy level as well.
Yeah. And that brings up a great point. So one of the big things that we talk about a lot of times with third party candidates or folks that are kind of frustrated that the third parties or, you know, independents or Greens or Libertarians aren't winning the elections that they had hoped to win. You know, they're just not moving the needle as much as they had really hoped or seen.
Right.
And we talk a lot about winning without winning the electorate, actually, you know, changing the conversation, doing things in the community outside, like mutual aid programs and stuff that do have a major impact, changing the actual narrative that the two parties actually talk about. And that brings up, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was the culture of winning pieces that you're doing and how. Mm-hmm. You know, not only, yes, I want to talk about the Libertarian Party and how we make create a culture of winning there, but how do we also make people outside of that two-party system in general feel that they're doing something positive, they're doing something that actually moves the needle, and they're actually, you know, impacting their communities in the way that they wish they're trying to hope and do so by running or, you know, doing protests or anything like that, direct action.
Sure. So let me first talk about what culture of winning is for those who don't know, and what the catalyst was behind this. Joe Jorgensen and I got 1.3% in the election, and we were third place. We got third place in all 50 states. It's and we widened the gap between us and the other so-called third parties. Yep. We have cemented ourselves solidly as third place, and you know, but we got 1.2%, and it was actually less than we got in 2016. Our candidates got 3.2 when we got 1.3 or whatever. And I was congratulated. I had libertarians, people who have been libertarians sometimes for decades, who were like, wow, what a great job you did. And I said, we just got over 1%. And they said, yeah, but if you think about it, you know, this is the best we've ever done during a presidential reelection cycle. You know, that time we got 3.something%, it was when there wasn't an incumbent running for reelection. And we know that statistically voters are more likely to either vote for or against, directly against the incumbent, and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, and then when you factor in COVID and the lockdowns and, the fact that we weren't able to, you know, afford to get our message out there, and the way that we're being treated by the Commission on Presidential Debates and the major media, we did a great job. And I went, okay. And I realized something. We have become conditioned to be okay with losing admirably.
Right.
And from an electoral standpoint, that is bad. Did we get the message out there? Absolutely. Did we help down ballot candidates who did win their races or come close to winning? Absolutely. Yep. Did we grow paid membership to the highest level it's ever been? Absolutely. Did we grow the number of people registered as libertarians to the highest level they've ever been? Absolutely. We did all of these things. It's unacceptable that after nearly 50 years of existence, we are still fighting over whether we're going to get 1% or 2%. It's and we have to look at why that's happening. I contend that we largely have, in order to protect ourselves and in order to try to find the silver linings, we have created a culture of losing admirably. We've created a culture of saying, yeah, but when you think about it, we actually did really good. But the problem is, and it's good to find silver linings, but you can't do that at the expense of not actually examining what went wrong and what you could do better. Yes, right. We can talk about the fact that ballot access laws and lack of access to taxpayer funding, which we wouldn't want anyway, and that all these things that have been built to make it harder for us to run as candidates are what have made it harder. We can absolutely do that. Those things aren't going to change until we get into office.
Right.
And we're not going to get into office unless we find workarounds around that. So instead of focusing on that, let's focus on how we can win. Yep. And I realized something. We had something like 20 libertarians or 25 libertarians win office in this last election at the local level. And I thought, well, they won. Let's go talk to them. Yeah. So I made Culture of Winning, which is a show where I talk to libertarians who have been elected to office to see, why did you run? What motivated you to do this? How did you win? How did you campaign? What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced? You know, and how did you overcome them? What were the, you know, what if you had to give one bit of advice to the people that are watching this who are thinking of running or helping someone else run, what would you give? And then, you know, what other thoughts do you have about this? And that's what we do with the show. The show is to demystify the idea of libertarians getting elected to office, because it happens every single election cycle, and to break down how they win so that we can build a blueprint for winning other elections. What works for city council works for county council, works for mayor, works for state legislature, works for the governor's mansion, works for Congress, works for Senate, works for the White House. It's just scaled up, but it's the same stuff. So let's figure out how to do it. Let's do more of it, and then let's work our way up. So how that relates to building a culture of winning in general. Instead of looking for reasons why you're not going to do well, and then shooting for an unrealistic goal that's never going to happen with no real plan to actually accomplish it, because we're already at a disadvantage anyway, which is a standard coping mechanism for people who know that they're not going to be able to accomplish it. Don't do that. Look for things you can actually accomplish, even if they're this big, if they look absolutely tiny, and then go do that thing. Yep. If you are starting a direct action group, instead of saying, I'm going to conquer the police station. No, you're not.
Right.
But here's what you can do. You might be able to get people together who are willing to work on, you know, a shared needle drive or to work on a needle exchange. Yeah. Don't share needles.
Yeah.
a needle exchange. You might be able to get together a group of people who are going to go and illegally feed the homeless and create a news item for the day of people finding out that it's illegal to feed homeless people without a license, right? You can do those types of things. And so how do you do that? Well, I got to get 5 people together. Well, there's your goal.
Yep.
Get 5 people. And now you can check that off and say, I won that. I'm a winner.
Yep.
Then you get together, you go and you say, I got to raise $150 to be able to get enough food together to make sandwiches and go and feed them to the homeless. Okay. So you go and you work, you get that 150 or 200 or whatever, boom, you just won again. You're on a roll. And so now you go and you say, okay, our goal is we're going to disseminate these sandwiches out to people, and we're going to try to feed every single homeless person. And these are the people that are willing to get arrested. These are the people who can't get arrested. They either have priors, or, you know, they have a bench warrant, or they have something that makes it where they don't want to go to jail, or they're, you know, they have their medical issue, or they just don't want to go to jail. Okay. So here are the people that are ready to go to jail. Here are the people who, for a variety of reasons that are fully respectable and totally understandable, do not. So we're going to make sure, okay, if the police come and try to stop us, these are the folks that are going to be okay with that and being arrested. And these are the ones who are just going to stand on the sidelines and say, hey, look, we aren't allowed to feed homeless people. Look what they're doing. Right.
Right.
And so go out and do that. Boom. You just won again. Yep. This is, and so instead of shooting for, we're going to take this city back for the people, when you don't even have 5 people that are ready yet to help you feed sandwiches to homeless people, let's focus on things that we can win, because that sandwich drive can lead to bigger sandwich drives, can lead to working with other organizations who didn't even know that it was illegal to feed homeless people. And now they want to work with you. Now they want to give you a platform to speak from. Now you can talk to homeless advocacy groups. Now you can talk to, you know, anti-poverty groups. Now you can talk to other mutual aid groups and direct action groups. These are the kind of things that happen when you recalibrate the way that you think about winning. When I was 16 years old and I started my business, I wasn't worried about becoming a billionaire and shooting to compete with, you know, Bill Gates or you know, the people who owned Netscape or what. I'm dating myself right now. Like, I wasn't worried about that. Right. I was worried about taking my laptop and my 1986 LeBaron and going around to businesses and saying, hey, you want a free website? And they'd go, what's a website? And I go, it's a free thing. You want it? And then I go and make their site and build up a portfolio. Those were wins for me. And then I would go on and actually charge people and be able to make a proper business out of it. But it was because I focused on, here's what I can actually do. And I didn't have an ethos or philosophical concept behind it. It just made sense to me. Here's what I can do. I'm going to go do that. So let's go do that. So in politics, the way I'm going to look at this is, here are the races we can win right now. So let's go find people who can run in them. Let's go give them the tools to be able to do it. And let's go win those damn races. And let's go then find other races that we have somewhat of a chance of winning. And let's go apply those same principles to that and try to win those. And when we get to 2022, let's try to actually do it for congressional races. Yeah. And when we get to 2024, let's try to actually get whoever we put as the candidate, get them enough support behind them that it qualifies them for the debate stage so they can blow the whole damn thing wide open.
Right.
That's what culture of winning is.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more with the goals behind it and the motivation behind it. I think it's one of the things that was severely lacking in all third parties, specifically in the Libertarian Party. I saw it because I was part of the Libertarian Party for some time. You hear those qualifiers commonly. You know, we had the least amount of money per vote in, you know, the election, or like, you know, the. It was just qualifying. And I get it. You put a lot of work and time into running, and you know, blood, sweat, and tears for sure go into a lot of these elections. And I get you're trying to find a way that you did kind of win or whatever, but it's not a win that you can build off of. It's not a win that you can say you made that significant impact to your community or anything like that. And I think there is, like you were saying, small wins that we need to recognize are valid and really do need to be sometimes the primary goal. If someone wants to run for a state Senate, that's a very hard race to jump right into as a Libertarian and win. It can happen, but it's very, very. So maybe you do run a local mayor election, city council election, and then you win there, and then you grow that kind of political capital so that you can speak on those larger scenes. And like you said, you do make the connections after you've seen a win. So.
Oh, absolutely. You make more connections. And once I get through this, you know, most recent slate of people who won elections for 2020, and that'll probably take me into next month. Once I get through them, then I'm going to talk to people who have won races in the past. And then I'm going to speak to people who came really close to winning their races. And I actually already have someone booked who they lost their first race, but the connections they made by running a really positive, issues-oriented, community-oriented campaign led to one of their competitors, opponents, appointing them to a board for some kind of advisory board, which grew their name within the community. And then when they ran for that, I think another office, they ended up winning. Yep. So wins, I'm not against identifying where we went right and finding silver linings. I'm not against recognizing things that we have no control over and saying, hey, listen, you know, we can't win because of this and we've got to try to work around it or whatever. But when your primary focus is on finding nuggets of good and ignoring the fact that there was a lot to learn from this that we could do in the future, you are not learning, you're just losing. You know, my mindset has always been, I want to either win or learn. Yep. If I don't learn, then I lost. Right. I just lost. And I didn't just lose the race or the competition or whatever I was trying to get. I also lost the opportunity to learn from it and be able to forge ahead and do better the next time. Right. So I think that, you know, a big part of the culture of winning is being willing and eager, seeing losses, not being afraid of losses, but seeing losses as an opportunity to learn, but then actually learning from them, not just saying, oh, well, we did a good job if you think about it. Okay, great. I'd like to actually win if you think about it. Like, I'd like to walk away and say, hey, we just won this election if you think about it. And you're never going to be able to get that way, get to actually winning if you're constantly trying to rationalize and explain why this is good.
Right. No, I completely agree. And I think one of the big things you touched on too was kind of educating folks about the Libertarian Party or whatever third party you're running in. I think that's a huge win in itself, just trying to grow the outreach. And I think this doesn't have to be done during an election. I think this could be done with mutual aid, direct action programs in your communities. I know our local affiliate is looking to do a cleanup around one of the reservoirs and then also providing some showers and meals and stuff to the homeless folks in the Worcester area. Yeah, I think there's, wearing your third party paraphernalia and going out and doing some good. Yes. I think it feels cheesy. It feels like you're playing this. You got to do it. It's the only way that people know that there's good people out there doing things other than the D's or R's or whoever you back in the major parties and stuff. So
we often will say things. I told people, because I've had people come to me and say, yeah, I'm thinking of running for whatever in 2022. And I go, okay, what are you doing right now? And they're like, well, I'm talking to you because I don't know what to do. And I go, okay, good. That's a good first step. Yep. Here's what you need to do. Get involved in charity and mutual aid drives in your community and show up as someone who, show up with your, do a light touch. Don't show up and go, hey, I'm Bill Smith and I'm running for office and that's why I'm here to help. No, don't do that. Don't do that. Show up with like a liberty thing on. And when people go, hey, what's that? You go, oh, I'm a libertarian. I think that people do best when we're most free. And I think this is a perfect example of that. And then leave it at that. You don't have to convert anyone. Just show them that you give a crap about them and other people. Okay. Yeah. Get out into your community. Do, whatever you can to show, go to city council meetings, go to county council meetings, go there and listen to other people's concerns, go there and say what your concerns are, but listen to other people. And then afterwards go and talk to them and say, hey, listen, I agree with you on that. I think that we should be holding police officers accountable. I think we should be decriminalizing marijuana. I think that we should, protect the right to keep and bear arms. I think that we should be, condemning the actions of this president or this person or whatever. Right. I agree with that. Hey, I'd like to continue talking about this in the future. Build connections with people, even if they don't agree with you, especially if they don't agree with you.
Right.
And leave them walking away with a warm and fuzzy feeling about you. You do not have to convert them in that moment. You are unlikely to, and you're more likely to alienate them. Tell them a few things about what you think. If they tell you why you disagree, you can go, yeah, well, here's what I think about that. But, that's a good point too. But really, I think it's more important to focus on what we agree on. Make them like you.
Yeah. Yeah.
These are basic things.
Yeah. And I think one of the big things too, like we were just talking about, the libertarians especially like to say that the best use and of funds and time is spent directly in your community, you impacting your community. If you're going to get on a stage and say that, you best be sure you are doing that before people see you there the first time. Yeah. If the first time they've seen you in your community is standing on that stage and not going out there and doing the actual work, you've lost them. You've lost them immediately.
And if your candidate that you're running against is worth a grain of salt, and they know that you never have existed in this world except to run against them, and you say some nonsense like that, they're going to go, where you been?
Yep.
Because I guarantee you that politician has done that stuff, if only for the opportunity to glad hand. And so now you're going to be sitting there like, well, I didn't mean me.
Right.
Like, now you made what you just said look foolish, right? You made it look silly. Or even if you drove your point home, you made the other candidate look better.
Right.
Prove that we believe what we believe. Okay. Yep. And if you're not someone, and I meet a lot of people who go, you know what? I'm not really a people person. I don't want to be out there knocking on doors. I don't want to be out there doing the feeding. I'd much rather do the messaging stuff. That's great. Yep. Everyone is different. Okay. Maybe you shouldn't be running for office. Maybe you should be helping someone else who wants to run for office to do that back end stuff, whether it's graphic design, marketing, social media posting, video content creation, whatever. Whatever it is you do and your wheelhouse is, go do that and avail yourself to someone who is ready to go and, you know, kiss babies and shake hands and do the and you know, do charity stuff and get out in the community and make them their names known. It's okay for someone else to do that and for you to help. Not everyone has to run for office. Some people shouldn't run for office.
Oh yeah. And to your point, you know, those mutual aid places, those organizations, those nonprofits, they need graphic designers and folks doing the messaging behind the scenes, counting, you know, bringing in fundraising dollars and being able to distribute those to the folks that are spending the money. They need folks like that behind the scenes. That is one of the biggest needs, because the people who are drawn to do this are the folks that want to go out there and physically hand out the thing. So, you know, I think there's great opportunity.
You're right. I hadn't even thought of that. You're right. Because I am one of those people. So I'm like, yeah, go and help at the soup kitchen. But who makes the graphic designs?
Right.
Who makes the flyers? Who advertises it on social media? That might be your thing.
Right.
You may be someone that, you know, you're fine with these lockdowns because you don't like going outside anyway. Right. You don't like people. You don't like being out there, you know, and that's fine. That's who you are. And that's, there's nothing, everyone is different, right? Not everyone is a freaking, like, you know, social butterfly monster hybrid like I am. Right. So go, you go out there and put your name out there, you know, send messages to Facebook groups and Facebook pages and emails to websites and be like, hey, I'd like to help with your graphic design. I'd like to help with your whatever. And that's a way of winning. That's a way of actually helping a cause that you care about without putting yourself out there in a way that you don't want to.
That's right. Yeah. So I think we kind of went through a lot of the culture of winning piece, and I wanted to make sure we talked about healthcare, because I know, so a lot of folks on this page, we talk about a lot of, we're very open about sharing ideas and what different parties are bringing to the table as far as fixing the real problems that we're facing. Healthcare is a very immediate problem that a lot of people are facing. They can't afford medication, their actual care. They come home with bills they can't afford. There's a very real problem. Medicare for All has been a widely popularized piece of legislation among, or not even a piece of legislation, I guess an idea, I guess, or maybe some legislation among progressives and some of the Green Party folks as well. And there's a lot in there that I get, because it is probably one of the only pieces of highly publicized ideas that would help in the short term people get their health care. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that worries me. And I think that I've heard you explain health care a few times, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about some of the ways that the folks, you know, we're not going to change minds in 20 minutes. Even if folks still want Medicare for All, the things that we could put in place before that or during that or whatever that are the right idea, I think, about decentralizing and removing IP laws and all the stuff that I think we're going to talk about, would help that be cheaper in the long run. Let's just, you know,
exactly,
it's a win-win kind of thing. So I wanted to kind of bring you in and hear it, because I've heard it a few times from you, and I really like the way that you kind of build the argument and put it together. So I just want to hear, how do we make healthcare affordable the libertarian way, and you know, just in general for folks to be able to afford, you know, the general health services.
Right. So let's first of all recognize that, and I don't think I'm going to be making any controversial statement here, that we didn't need this pandemic to know that our healthcare system is an absolute mess.
Right.
That was designed largely to profit and benefit a small, cynical handful of incredibly powerful cronies and their favored politicians. The system was not designed for us, clearly.
No.
Okay. A system whereby you could end up in an emergency room and have it ruin you financially for the rest of your life is not a system that was designed for us. A system where people have heart attacks at home and weigh the risks of going to the hospital because they think, well, I can probably survive this, but I don't know how I could handle, you know, passing on that kind of debt to my children and grandchildren. This right. is a system that was not designed for us. It was designed to fleece us for the benefit of very powerful people. And as a result, it has massively driven up the cost of healthcare. Now, like you said, we could get into, you know, the best way to you know, create, you know, who basically who should be paying for healthcare, pretty much. Yeah. We could get into that argument all day long, but I think what we can agree on is that we need to remove the regulations and protections for big businesses that have enriched them at your expense. So, for example, we need to get rid of cost plus. Cost plus was implemented for a cost control. And the idea behind Cost Plus was if I am selling you a saline bag, instead of being able to charge you 10 times as much as that saline bag costs, then I should only be able to charge you, let's say, 20% or 10% of what that saline bag costs. Cost Plus. The problem with Cost Plus is that it incentivizes me paying more for the saline bag. So if I have two suppliers to choose from, one of them says, this saline bag costs us like 60 cents to make. We'll sell it to you for $3. And I go, yeah, but then I can only charge $3.30. I only make 30 cents off that saline bag. And right. another company comes in and goes, that exact saline bag will sell you for $700. And I go, well, then I can charge $770 and I get to keep $70.
Right.
That's what has driven up the wholesale supply cost of healthcare. And so that's something that needs to go. We need to get rid of patent protections for drugs that have been around longer than any of us have been alive. There's absolutely no reason for there to be a patent protection on insulin.
Right.
You can go on Wikipedia and it shows you the formulary for insulin. This is not some groundbreaking drug, but it is a life-saving drug. And there's no reason it should cost thousands of dollars. It should cost pennies because that's what it costs to make. We should get rid of rules that ban the import of drugs from other countries. You should be able to buy drugs wherever you want to. You have, you know, you've been told you need this drug. Go get the drug. You should be able to get it. There's no and what that does is it provides more competition so that everyone has to stay honest with what they're charging you. We need to get rid of certificate of need laws that allow major hospital systems and healthcare provider systems. They allow them to stop smaller competitors from entering into their protected market and threatening their market share. But what happens there is it reduces supply and eliminates competition. So you pay more and have less access to care. We need to get rid of that kind of stuff. We need to get rid of this insurance system. And I know that's more of a long-term thing, but you know, any system whereby instead of you just going to the doctor and getting the service that you need and there being a price equilibrium where I can only charge you as the doctor, I can only charge you what you can afford. And if I don't, I'm not going to have any customers. And replacing that with this system whereby you pay a fixed amount every month, and then you come and we run it through their Byzantine system to see if it's covered and for how much. And now there are all these bureaucrats that are being, you know, all these administrators that are being, you know, like all it's a mess. We need to get rid of that. But that's a longer term thing because we have to ask in order to do that, we have to answer the question of, well, who's going to pay for it if we get rid of that? So we'll leave that off the table. What's another thing we got to get rid of? I mean, that's really a lot of the stuff, but taxes and regulations and mandates drive up roughly 70 to 75% of the cost of healthcare.
And it's crazy. And, I mean, there's examples, like real life examples where there were two, Hody brings this example all the time to me. There are two makers of the same exact medication that is treating, I can't remember exactly, it's an autoimmune disease, but there was two suppliers for this, two manufacturers of this drug. It was literally being given away so they could advertise other drugs on the bottle. That's how cheap it was. Free. They were giving it away because it was so cheap to manufacture, and they were actually using it to promote the other drugs that they offered in that space to help folks out. As they were able to get a patent that created a monopoly of one person able to make that drug, it now costs $150,000 to $250,000 for a bottle. Now it doesn't cost the individual that, there's insurance and all that stuff, but it's still, that's what
that is cost what they're getting for.
Yeah.
And that cost is being absorbed by the entire healthcare system.
Right.
Yep. And that is money that could have been spent on research and development, and instead it's being spent on a drug that literally is so cheap to make that they used to use it as a banner for other drugs.
Exactly. And I'll put it in the comments after this. I'll ask Cody. I ask Cody probably once every other month because it's a long name that I never remember. But it's on Wikipedia. You can see it, and it tells you exactly what happened. And it's things like this that I think people don't realize are going on. There's a lot of education. There's a lot of, sleight of hand. There are people trying to hide that these things are going on, of course, to protect their profits and their kind of crony system that they've built up. But as long as folks know that these are issues, they can bring these along with whatever, you know,
prefer of having it paid for. If we get rid of the regulations that drive up the costs that were written by the cronies who put them in place, then we do a great bit to reduce the cost of not just of what people are paying out of pocket for insurance, but we reduce the cost of Medicare. We reduce the cost of Medicaid. We reduce the cost of Social Security, because a lot of Social Security is like SSI and disability and stuff, which is based on people's ability to pay. It also reduces the cost of the VA. Every bit of it reduces the cost of the state insurance programs and children's health insurance and all that stuff. It reduces anything related to Medicaid, healthcare and medication. It reduces that cost. Another big thing to do is end the war on drugs, because if people could use cannabis and for their pain needs, and if people could use psilocybin and ketamine and some of these other things for their psychological and mental illnesses, then Big Pharma would lose out big there as well. One thing I do have to note, and this is not to, you know, I know we don't want to get into the debate, but this is just, it's just a, like, you can look it up yourself. We are often told that the reason we need Medicare for All, because it will eliminate a lot of these regulations. That's patently false. So Medicare is the most actually, that's not true. The VA, ironically enough, is the most expensive means. If you look at the cost per patient of the VA, it is easily the most expensive form of healthcare in this country, followed closely behind by Medicare. Okay. Yep. And that's when you factor what's being paid by government and what's being paid out of pocket in all of these systems. And the reason is because Medicare has a massive network and formulary behind it and a huge government-run bureaucracy, which is fine-tuned for the benefit of the lobbyists that put the politicians in place, that put the regulators in place. And we have this sort of, you know, revolving door of people going out of Health and Human Services and back into Big Pharma, and then out of Big Pharma and back into Health and Human Services. Anyone who thinks that the government getting total control of the way of paying for this while continuing to keep in place the corporate structure that drove up the cost in the first place, I got news for you. That's not how it works, folks. We either need to go free market or we need to nationalize healthcare. Like, you need to pick a side. Medicare for All is the worst of all worlds.
And I'm even, so you listened, so before Medicare for All became a national kind of talking point, I guess, for a lot of the progressive candidates, you heard them speak about the issues with Medicare. Bernie Sanders talked about many, many times that it is a law that Medicare cannot negotiate with pharmaceutical companies. It's a law. They are not allowed to negotiate pricing down. They have to get whatever they say is the price for Medicare. And Bernie Sanders brought that up. Like I said, I heard that out of him back when he was running against Hillary. I mean, it was a big talk. And like I said, even if we can have the debate later about who's going to pay for it. Let's make it as efficient as possible,
no matter how it's paid for.
Exactly.
And let's recognize that the purpose of this system, and this is something everyone gets to feel warm and fuzzy about, whether you're in the Tea Party crowd, the Libertarian crowd, the Occupy crowd, the Anarchist crowd, whatever, this is a perfect example of what happens when you merge the interests of government and large enterprise. Right. And you create the conditions for the merging of government and enterprise when you put government in charge of that thing to begin with, because you are giving them the ability. They have now created a supply of favors that they can hand out that you and your children and future generations that haven't even been born yet have to pay off with interest. That's why there's so much money in politics. Right. That is why in this race in Georgia, they just spent over $1 billion on two Senate races, and the salaries for those races, the salaries for those seats total about $300,000+. If you are spending $1 billion to get a job that pays you $300,000, there are favors being handed out afterwards.
Very much so. Yeah, there's no way that those offices don't come with some strings attached that are,
of course,
you know, maybe good financially for the folks getting into those seats, but bad for the rest of us who can't afford to give $500,000 to a political candidate. I mean, it's
or create a, you know, a $50 million super PAC or, right, you know, whatever else, you know. A system where power is centralized is a system where people who don't have access to that power that has been stolen from them. Because, right, keep in mind, this isn't their power rightfully. That's, right, power that's been stolen from you. That's money that's been stolen from you. That's freedom and opportunity that's been stolen from you and centralized, expropriated to a small handful of people. And any system that is based on the stealing and centralization of power directly and disproportionately harms people the further away and the less adjacent to that power that they are. That is why marginalized communities are the most hurt in this system. That is why poor people are the most infringed upon in this system. That is why the closer to wealth and power you get, the less infringed you are. But the reality is, if you're part of the 99.99% of people that don't have that immediate access to, right, to power, are you being treated better if you're worth six figures instead of worth nothing? Yes. Yeah. Are you ultimately still at the whim of those who can control your life and make it disappear if they want to? Yes.
Right.
Oh, it's, yeah, not the 99% versus the 1%. It's the 99.99% versus the 0.001%.
Right. Oh, I completely agree. And on, you know, that note, how do we, and this is, you know, changing gears for sure, but how do we harness the, you know, there's a lot of folks that are upset with the two-party system. They might fall into different buckets all over, you know, the political sphere, but they are upset with the way that things are going because they feel like they no longer have a voice. They feel like they do, you know, if they are going to their elected officials and speaking, it's falling on deaf ears, and they're feeling like there's no real way that they can influence, you know, the laws that are being kind of put down onto them. How do we harness that into partnerships and, you know, alliances or whatever you want? And I know some of it happens today in Ohio. The Green Party and Libertarian Party fight together for ballot access. You know, yep, when the Democrats, yep, and Republicans go and try and sue them to get off the ballot, they work together to sue, you know, to defend their ballot access. And I think, mm-hmm, that's one kind of macro example, but there are thousands and thousands of micro examples, I believe, that can happen, like decriminalizing marijuana for the states that don't have that right now. How many of those folks that feel are disenfranchised from the two-party system believe in deregulating marijuana? I mean, almost every, exactly, single one of those groups.
Exactly, exactly. So my thing is this, going back to the whole idea of culture of winning. Mm-hmm. If we recognize that there is a powerful system that has been put in place that leaves us with little to no hope of being able to immediately supplant it, immediately being able to kick them out, immediately being able to replace them with people who are going to dismantle this stuff and re-empower individuals and communities. If we recognize that that's not going to happen, let's look at what we can do. Yep. Can we coalition to work on decriminalization of marijuana or even decriminalization of drugs? That just happened in Oregon. Literally, right, all drugs now, right? Can we work together on things like decriminalizing sex work? Can we work together on things like, you know, decriminalizing, you know, pretty much any victimless crime? Can, right, can we get government out of harming people for not hurting anyone? Can we work on initiatives to remove the fine structure that funds most municipalities, where, you know, the way that municipalities are primarily funded is through giving someone a $200 or $300 ticket for their taillight being out or their seatbelt not being on, ruining them financially for, right, weeks, right? Or, you know, absurd parking ticket schemes and things like this, getting rid of that kind of stuff so that we're no longer issuing these regressive taxes against the people who are the most likely to be ruined financially. You know, right. For me, I get a $200 fine and I'm not a billionaire, but I get a $200 fine. I'm like, yeah, this is stupid. But there are other people, they get a $200 fine and they go, how am I going to be able to pay for my rent or be able to pay my utilities or be that this was money I 100% needed. I actually needed more money than this. I'm already falling behind and now I've been robbed. These are the types of things that we can work on together if we identify winnable action items and move forward on that. And so, for example, you know, we were talking about healthcare. I would love to get into a debate about, you know, the merits or lack thereof behind something like Medicare for All or nationalization of healthcare. And that's a great conversation we can have in the future. It's a fun debate we can have as a side item or something like that. Yeah. But ultimately, if we all recognize that certificate of need laws are bad, if we all recognize that patent protections on drugs that have been around forever are bad, if we all recognize that cost plus is a proven failure, if we all recognize that these things, the war on drugs is bad, if we recognize that these things are bad, drive up the cost of healthcare and cause people to die or be financially ruined or both, then let's focus on advocating for things that we all agree on. We can focus on the, once we've achieved the utopia that is already accomplishing everything we already agree on, we brought the troops home, we've ended the wars, you know, we got, now we can focus on, are we going to have a single payer system or are we going to have a pay out of your pockets? Like whatever. We can focus on that once we've accomplished the things that we are able to accomplish together. And I think it's just a difference of mindset. You know, one of the reasons I've tried to open up dialogues with Green Party people and Democratic Socialists and you know, anarcho-communists and people who definitely don't fall within the typical, you know, Libertarian Party sphere is because I need them to, or I want them to recognize that on so many things, we're on the same team. And yes, there are some issues where we're on definitely diametrically opposing teams. And on those issues, we're certainly not going to be able to coalition very much. So let's focus on, and we are of absolutely zero relevance in those issues anyway. So let's focus on the stuff we can actually get accomplished. And then we can work together, pool together our resources, you know, multiply our labor and be able to actually get some things accomplished. I would love for a day where the Green Party and the Libertarians can step back and go, well, we did all the stuff we agree on. Now let's argue about the stuff we don't agree on. Let's get to that. Let's get to that world and then we can figure the rest out.
That's exactly what I try and, you know, that's part of the point of this entire podcast, why I try to start it. I bring on folks in, you know, progressive Dems. I bring on Libertarian folks, Green Party folks. I'm trying to bring on as many different political ideologies, Republicans. If they're trying to do something that is going to make the world a better place without hurting anyone, why aren't we working on that together? We're shooting ourselves in the foot by trying to go up against a machine that is the two-party system.
Who works together all the time, right? Democrats and Republicans. This is why I call them the Republicrats. Right. Because it is a exercise in naivete and futility to pretend that they're opposing forces. They are not. They work together all day long to screw us over. Republicans and Democrats agree on two very crucial things. One is that every day is a special new day to screw over the American people just a little bit more than they did the day before. And no one else should be able to seriously contend for this positions of power that they have. The only way we have a shot in hell of challenging them in any real way, much less eventually replacing them, is to work together if and whenever we can. And also potentially to work within people in their ranks. If there is a justice Democrat who wants to work with me on criminal justice reform or decriminalization of drugs or ending the war on drugs or protecting sex workers by, you know, decriminalizing, I will 100% work with them. Yep. If there is a Republican out there who wants to work with me on protecting and affirming our right to keep and bear arms or on, you know, eliminating or lowering taxes or regulations on small businesses, I will 100% work with them, even if immediately or during that time we are on opposing sides when it comes to immigration or on, you know, foreign policy or on whatever else, or if with the Democrat we are diametrically opposed when it comes to things like healthcare, although again, like you said, there's even things there that we can agree on. Yeah. And you know, even if there are things, or gun control or whatever else, if there are things that I can work with someone on and be an ally with, two things happen. Number one, We are no longer just the sum of our parts. We are now working together as a stronger, cohesive unit. And number two, you are building relationships with people that you didn't have relationships with before. And if you want to go from 2% to 50%, you have to bring new people in. And the first step to that is getting them to recognize. And what I'm saying for Green Party, if you want the Green Party one day to get 50% and be able to replace Republicans and Democrats and be the dominant party who's able to achieve all of the social equity and justice that you want to see in the world, you have to bring people in. And the way that you do that is by starting a dialogue with people and finding common ground. And over the course of finding that common ground, you are able to say, hey, by the way, this is why I agree with this, because also I think that this, and if you think about it, it's really the same thing. And they go, oh, crap. Wow, he's right. This is how you influence people. Instead of screaming at them on the things you disagree on, you go, hey, you know this thing? I agree with you 100%. Let's work together on that. And see where it goes from there.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. Like I said, this is one of the main reasons I started this, you know, show, was trying to bring in a bunch of different political ideologies and have the tough conversations and then understand where, you know, where we do align best. And I think you kind of summed it up perfectly there. And we're right up against it. I appreciate, you know, all the time that you spent being able to talk with us. This was
absolutely awesome.
I'd love to have you on again, you know, breaking down some further you know, going further in depth on certificate of need laws or something like that. I think it would be just wonderful to educate the folks that haven't heard about these different ways and different levers, I guess, that we have to influence healthcare costs and stuff for the folks in our community. So
buddy, I would be more than happy to come on as often as I possibly can fit in my schedule. So I'd be happy to do that.
Oh, that's great. And I just want to thank you. You know, I appreciate your time. I know how busy you are. I talk with Brian and I'm on some of the team as well. So
yeah, you're on the team. Yeah, no, you know how busy I am because you're part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I appreciate it. And I hope you have a wonderful night, and I hope you enjoyed the time on the Post Political Podcast.
I had a great time, man. Your questions were awesome. I love your aesthetic here. I think it's really cool. And folks, I just want you, if you're watching this, you need to know that Derek is one of the best people that I know in the political world. This is a man who has no ulterior motive other than to set people free. And not just as like, you know, we're Americans, so we're always the people, free the people and liberty, and like actually set people free from literal cages, set people free from criminal records that they shouldn't have because they didn't hurt anyone, set people free from being trapped in bad schools and in low-income situations, and set them free from, you know, the burdens and barriers that have been imposed upon them by incredibly powerful and cynical people, so that we can thrive, so that people can reclaim what is theirs, so that people can thrive and prosper and build up their communities, so that we can put the ladders back so people can climb out of these safety nets and pull people up with them, so that they no longer need to live off the scraps and the crumbs that have been stolen from them by the people in power. Setting people free so that we can live far better lives than we can even imagine now. This is the kind of stuff that Derek works on every single day. That's why he's doing this show. Follow, subscribe, like, watch, hit the bell if this is on. I don't know if you're on YouTube. Do everything. Yep. Make sure, if you're watching this on YouTube, subscribe to Post Political Podcast. Hit the bell. Be sure to make it sure that you are, and share this content so other people can see it as well, because it is important that people see what Derek is talking about, which is working together so that we can have victories on the cultural front, on the social and direct action front, and on the political front, so we can actually improve the lives of people. Because if we're not doing that, then we are wasting our time and our lives in a greater sense. We're all one day not going to be here. And all that will matter 100 years from now is what impact we were able to make on the lives and the livelihoods and the futures of the people around us. And if we do a good job at that, then that will continue on in a positive way many, many years and decades after we've been gone. And that's all we can do while we're here. So follow Derek and he'll help you to do that.
Thanks, Mike. That was one of the most ringing endorsements that I've ever received personally. And I really appreciate it. It means a lot. Like I said, you are... When I first heard you speak, it was definitely a wake-up call and just a voice that I haven't heard as much in the Libertarian Party. You hear a lot of you know, and I, like I said, I might agree or whatever with some of these things, but the taxation stuff, the, you know, we need to deregulate everything and privatize the world. And, like, those types of things only will get in so many folks. It just, it's so wonderful to hear it being framed into a human perspective. And I do personally think it is one of the most compassionate things a person could strive for the rest of the folks in the world is to be free of the shackles that the government puts on us. I mean, physically, some people do get physical shackles put on
physically
them.
Physically shackled,
For smoking a plant, for, you know, feeding someone that is, you know, down on their luck and no longer in a home. Those things shouldn't be things that we're put in prisons for. And we, you know, I had a local guy in Boston earlier last week come on, and he said, you know, one of the things that America can tout nowadays is we are number one in incarceration. I mean, it's
with a bullet, like it's not even close. One out of every four people that's in prison on this planet is in America.
Exactly.
And of those people, and this is a scary one, one out of every 10 people. One out of every 12 people that is in prison is a veteran.
Yep.
They signed up to, and whatever you feel about the military, keep in mind, this is a person who has signed up to protect and defend the Constitution and the American people against all enemies, foreign and domestic. They often went overseas. And again, I think it was misguided what happened and that it shouldn't have been done. But these are people who signed up because they wanted to help people, or often because it was the only opportunity for them to be able to go to college or whatever else. So, so for whatever reason, they were cajoled into doing this. And now they're in prison, often for a victimless crime. They smoked a plant. They sold a substance. They owned a weapon, but they weren't hurting anyone. They just owned a weapon, weapon that the government can own 50 times, you know, over and much more powerful weapons, but that person can't. These things only end when we recognize them as injustices and work together to end them. And that's why I'm grateful that you're doing this. I'm grateful to everyone that's watching this, and stay tuned, because Derek's only getting started on working to get people together and building a network of people across the political spectrum who recognize that the only way we are going to take the power back is to recognize that the people in power are our primary opponent, and to create victories across the board so that we can eventually replace them and cause amazing things to happen in our families and in our communities.
Oh, thank you very much, Spike. And I couldn't have said it better myself. I think that was perfect. And I again want to thank you for coming on and hope you have a wonderful night. You know, thanks again.
Hey, thank you, man. I appreciate it.
So that was Spike Cohen. Like I said, he is one of the folks in the third party world that is trying to do what's right for folks, and framing the conversation in a way that we're talking about people and we're talking about them compassionately. We're trying to help people really be set free is, you know, kind of the tagline, but it's real. I mean, those folks are in jail for victimless crimes, or they're being forced into poverty because of laws and regulations that are being, you know, kind of forced upon us even locally. So I couldn't have said anything better than what Spike said at the end. So I'm just going to leave it there. But thank you all for joining us tonight. I am super happy to have Spike on. And I hope you guys enjoyed it. If you have any comments, please let me know how it went. And if there's anything else that you'd like to know, or anyone that you'd like to see on, you know, comment as well. I read through every single comment and try to provide answers where I can. So thanks for everyone joining, and I hope you have a great night.